Welcome to Shelf Life, a podcast from the Newberry Library about the humanities and the humans behind them. I'm Alex Teller, Director of Editorial Services at the Newberry. In this episode...
Very early on in the popular press, you see rhetoric which compares the freedom of the motor, of motoring with the railroad, and saying there is this other thing that really gives us an opportunity to go out into the country, explore things on our own and at our own pace.
From Kerouac's On the Road to car commercials starring Matthew McConaughey, driving has been portrayed again and again as a quintessentially American act, embodying principles of individual freedom and self-reliance. When did this idea emerge, and how did roadmaps of the 19th and 20th centuries spread it to an exponentially growing audience of car owners? I spoke with the Newberry's curator of maps, Jim Ackerman, about the rhetoric surrounding automobiles early on, how roadmaps promoted driving differently as the American highway system grew, and whether or not Google Maps and in-car navigation are negating the freedom that cars have been promising us from the very beginning. As curator of maps here at the Newberry, you oversee a collection of, what, over 600,000 maps?
That's what we think.
Okay, yeah. All right. And those maps range from, you know, Portland maps from the medieval era, yeah. The earliest printed atlases in the Renaissance, and a large collection of road maps, which lately you've been getting really jazzed about,
sure.
And really interested,
yeah.
In. Yeah. So, yeah, I just wanted to start there. Like, what made you kind of turn your attention to these road maps? Why are you fascinated by them? What's their significance?
Right. Well, how we got into this collecting is not entirely about me. The library has always had a great collection in the history of travel, going back to early exploration accounts, great collection of railroad archives that have a lot of tourism material, great Western Americana collection that includes a lot of travel accounts and maps relating to American expansion to the West. So in a way, the roadmaps fit rather neatly into what was already a strength. But more specifically, the Chicago connection with the roadmap publishing industry. In the late 1980s, the Rand McNally Company, which has strong personal ties as well as traditional ties with the Newberry Library, gave its entire backlog, historical library of all of its old maps, which include and other publications, geographies, and so on. So my predecessor as curator of maps, Bob Caro, I guess with a little bit of consultation with me, because he knew I was interested in the subject, we talked about wanting, well before I was curator of maps, talking about wanting to expand that foundation, particularly in the area of 20th century roadmaps, reasoning that somebody had to do this, I guess, to a certain extent. This was a kind of print material that in the 1980s was starting to go out of fashion, or at least the idea was that it was going out of fashion and that somebody might want to preserve it institutionally.
The idea of creating roadmaps and providing people with roadmaps.
The idea of paper roadmaps, which right. I'm happy to say hasn't completely disappeared. There was a sense that this was an archive of American culture in the 20th century that wasn't necessarily well represented in major libraries and other kinds of cultural institutions. So Bob reached out to other publishers who historically had been associated with roadmap publishing, especially what we call gas maps or oil company maps. These are the free maps that people used to give away at gas stations, that companies would give away at gas stations, and succeeded through his persistence, Bob's persistence. I won't claim credit for this. Through his persistence, was able to acquire those as gifts. Those arrived, I think, about the turn of the 21st century. I forget the exact dates. And subsequently, he acquired several other collections of smaller publishers. So As a scholar, I was, for much of this history, I was a director of the Smith Center for the History of Cartography, which I still am. As a scholar, you're partly driven by, you know, your own personal interests, and you're also responding to what's there in collections. Mm. So the other part of the answer to this question is that I had always been interested in maps. You will ask a lot of people who are interested in maps, and they tell you that, you know, I don't remember when I first started being fascinated with them. But I was one of those kids that would assist on reading roadmaps and help with the trip planning when we were on vacation. Or my mother would put it that she threw a map in the back seat to keep me quiet. And I was always interested also in street maps. I grew up in those Chicago suburbs, and I was always fascinated with the street network. I used to make maps on shirt cardboard, which is another old relic. My father would get his shirts pressed, usually white shirts, every, you know, week or so, and they'd come back from the cleaners with, after they'd been starched, with about an 8.5 by 11 piece of cardboard that had a nice white surface on the back. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I guess I got started making maps on these of imaginary cities and imaginary countries. But I collected roadmaps. I would say that my very strong interest was always in travel and roadmaps. And then fast forward to through my graduate career and ending up here at the Newberry Library, and lo and behold, about the time I had finished my dissertation, which was on another subject, here comes into my lap this great collection of roadmaps. And so I don't know if I made a, I think I was asked to write a paper for a library conference about the Newberry's acquisitions of roadmaps. And this all sort of built from there.
Are there any shirt cardboard maps in the Newberry's collection?
No, they're not. I think they got thrown away a long time ago.
One of the things about maps that I've realized in my time here at the Newberry is that they're not just objective representations of the world.
Sure.
There are a lot of editorial decisions that go into creating a map. They're in a lot of cases, they involve, you know, projections of fantasy and imagination wishful thinking.
Right.
So when roadmaps are first being produced at the turn of the 20th century, they're serving a functional purpose, I assume, but they're also kind of promoting specific ideas about cars and road travel. Could you talk about how that worked back then?
Sure. Actually, we have to go back to the bicycle era. I mean, I've been doing a lot of thinking about road mapping in the United States in the 19th century. So there is a precedent there. Mm-hmm. But there's no question that what some people call the mobility revolution at the end of the 19th century, which suddenly gave people of various technologies. We had the railroad already and the steamboat and so on, but suddenly technologies that gave them a lot of mobility locally beyond the traditional horses and things like that.
Gave individual people more mobility.
So example, we don't always think about this, but this included like streetcar railroads, which is a pretty dense network in many major large cities that would go out in the country. And there were actually publications that were made to accommodate tourists that were taking trolleys out into the country for various functional purposes. But the real push was the bicycle, which is not really an American invention, but was very aggressively developed in the 1880s and 1890s, especially in the Northeast. And there were clubs that were formed that were interested in promoting the development of better roads. They called it they were instrumental in what has been called the Good Roads Movement, to make the conditions under which they rode bicycles out in the country outside of Boston or New York or wherever better. And in the United States, unlike other parts of Western Europe, the rural road network was in many places not very good. There were plenty of roads, but there had not been a lot of attention except among local authorities to improve the roads. Where does mapping come into this? For mostly recreational, but very very strictly functional purposes, bicycle clubs as you know, I guess in a sort of an up, think of it as people who are enthusiastic about a new technology and really embrace it. And they're basically bicycle nerds, I guess you'd say, from the end of the 19th century. Mostly men, middle class or upper middle class, people with some spare time to spend these time on these diversions, would actually go out in the organization of local clubs and map the roads, which meant going out on existing roads and documenting what were the best roads for bicycles. And this would be not only whether the road surface was suitable, but also the gradients. If a obviously, if the gradient was too steep, it wasn't very good. We're not looking at these hyper bicyclists in most cases, like we are used to seeing people out on the roads today.
So it's kind of like a crowdsourced effort,
right? It was
to
a crowd
share the best 19... bicycle routes with people.
Yeah, good point. It was interesting crowdsourcing. So, and the League of the American Wheelmen, which was an umbrella group that was formed of these local clubs, also was very much involved in publishing publications that advocated improvement of roads. And so I see these mapping efforts and the promotional efforts as two sides of the same coin. Mm. In a way, you're creating the reality. As you're mapping these roads, you're making it possible for bicycling to happen and then ultimately motoring. And creating an entire new landscape. It wouldn't necessarily be immediately apparent. It's a landscape that's almost in some sense apparent through the maps.
Does mapping kind of demonstrate the importance of having better roads for bicycling?
Yes, I think it does. You know, the fact that you're mapping the best roads is implicitly saying that, come on, we need to spend some more money on these roads. Mm-hmm. A lot of the arguments were related to economic improvement and those kinds of things.
And then that puts pressure on
local governments, ultimately state governments, mm-hmm. and eventually, as we get into the motoring era, that's when the federal government starts to kick in. The transition from bicycle maps to road maps is it's a clear transitional period as we turn into the 20th century. In this country, practical automobiles that are actually being sold commercially start in 1896. You don't see any widespread expansion of the automobile market until the first decade of mm-hmm. the 20th century. And the early part of that decade, especially, a lot of the people who are bicycle advocates end up adopting the automobile and it's interesting because in today's world, we think of, especially in the current debates in Chicago about bicycle lanes and things like that, we see motorists and bicyclists as being at odds in some sense,
right.
You know, getting in each other's way. But in the early 20th century, these were very much the same people who were seeing the automobile as an expression of the same kinds of freedom and recreation, at some sense. This is not all by any means of what the automobile was about, seeing it as a further realization of what they already saw with the bicycle.
And that freedom is defined in contrast to the railroads?
Yes.
More or less?
Very early on in the popular press, you see rhetoric which explicitly compares the freedom of the motor, of motoring, mm-hmm. which would have been the term more or less, with the railroad. And not necessarily completely denigrating the railroad, mm-hmm. but saying there is this other thing that really gives us an opportunity to go out into the country, explore things on our own and at our own pace. Of course, initially was a very selective group. But after the First World War, this became very actively promoted on a much broader social scale as cars became more affordable. And that's a later part of the story, perhaps, but it's a part that's where automobile mapping really kicks in on a large scale.
So as a passenger on a train, you're constrained by the rail network, by the routes that the railroad company has fixed, literally physically fixed into place. And you're also just a passive passenger along the way. So that's kind of how car advocates, enthusiasts, drivers are sort of like defining them in opposition to in a car, you have a little bit more freedom to determine where you're going and how you get there.
The railroads embrace this to a certain extent. You know, the idea, at least say in the Western National Parks, the idea was to get railroads out, and then you'd get in stagecoaches and then later automobiles that were run often by concessioners that are owned by the railroads.
So they had sort of like a horizontal integration type of thing going on?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, initially it wasn't in opposition to it, but I think the rhetoric you would see among motoring enthusiasts was saying, this is so much better than the railroad. So where mapping comes into this, in the League of American Wheelmen, it's interesting to see how quickly bicycling disappears from popular sporting culture in the United States. It never completely goes away.
It just becomes more of like a niche activity.
It becomes a niche activity. I mean, we start to, you know, if you compare to Europe, cycling never really goes away. You think about all the great traditions of cycling and sport and so on, and you think of Europeans until, say, the last 30 years or so. Bicycles are kind of relegated to the sidewalks and thought of as a child's plaything rather than as something that you might use to commute to work, or you might ride them out in the country if you rent them. So this is the popular press, magazines like Outing and even popular magazines such as like the Century Magazine or Scribner's, which were kind of the Time magazine of their time, would have articles about in their recreation section about motoring as a sport. Not talking about just motor racing, but about getting out in the country.
It's a diversion. It's
recreation. A diversion, but it's also a very rigorous diversion because it was not easy to control these vehicles or to maintain them. And
the roads themselves were kind of treacherous, right?
Pretty bad, yeah. So the American Automobile Association and motor clubs that were associated with it, American Automobile Association was founded in, I'm going to get this wrong, around 1905.
Okay.
Might be a little
first early. Decade of the 20th
first
century.
Decade of the 20th century. And very quickly they engage in mapping for the same reason that the cyclists were engaged in mapping. They do a couple things. One is they're no longer satisfied entirely with mapping of local roads. There are a number of commercial companies by then that are producing local road maps, especially in the Northeast or around major metropolitan areas, that had used the same maps they used for bicycle maps and put them transform them into automobile oriented maps just by changing the title, basically. Mm-hmm. There is a very profound turn in the middle of the second decade of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. For one thing, the American Automobile Association around 1907 or so gets very much involved in what people call trailblazing. And that's a very weighted or pathfinding. Those were terms that were used alternatively. And if you think about American 19th century history, those are very weighted terms.
Right. Coded in a way.
Coded terms, culturally coded terms. And so there were people who were semi-professional, many of them cartographers, interestingly enough, who were engaged in determining what these transcontinental or interregional routes would be. And so But initially, now we know this, maybe the most famous of these transcontinental routes that were early laid out by motoring advocates is the Lincoln Highway, which is the one that has kind of survived as a historical relic, has its following and so on, much like Route 66 would have later. But the truth was, if you saw a map of the Lincoln Highway, you would think it's a great road. And they did spend some money in sort of demonstrating technologies at various places, demonstration miles. But mostly it was a connection of dirt roads. And it, as you get out west, so one of my favorite quotes is the notion of that it's a highway in name only. And so it is, to get back to that point of map sort of creating your own reality. It's creating the real own reality initially by just getting the idea of stoking the imagination of these transcontinental highways, but then also actively engaged in bringing this reality, bringing this into actual concrete.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, in describing driving as blazing a trail, mm-hmm. these roadmaps of the first couple decades of the 20th century are kind of appealing to the pioneering spirit of American culture, which, as you said, is a weighted term or weighted idea. As the highway system develops, becomes more expansive, becomes safer, later on in the 20th century, how do roadmaps change, and how do they change the way that they talk about driving?
It's significant that these earliest roadmaps are largely from not-for-profit promoters, or they're done to some extent by commercial publishers. Mm-hmm. When the period around the Great War or World War I is very significant in this transition. There was trouble moving men and material to the East Coast, especially, and the railroads were overtaxed. People started looking at highways and trucks, which are starting to develop motor trucks, as a way of transporting goods. At that point, it's not a massive effort. But this national defense argument, to a certain extent, sort of tips the balance in favor of promoting actually a state and national systems of roads. In 1916, there's the first Federal Road Aid Act. It was renewed in 1921 and then in 1926. And more or less in regular intervals, this happens all the way up to the present day. It becomes more comprehensively transportation-oriented now. But this was the first time that federal monies were actually allocated to the improvement of roads by various formulas over time. And even from the very beginning, those monies were funneled through the states. They required the states to set up their own highway departments or an authority that would receive the funds. It's beginning one of the earliest aspects of federalism of the 20th century state in some respects, too. States would be required to set up highway departments that would receive federal funds, also provide through their own taxes and so on. And this cooperative arrangement is actually still very much in existence today. And that would go towards improvement of roads, designating roads. And in time, roads, these old named roads became numbered roads. When, over the course of the late teens and 1920s, and even into the early 1930s, as the New Deal sort of accelerates investment in pavement of highways, once state and federal authorities take responsibility for designating and maintaining roads, the burden that had previously existed on people who were making road maps to give sort of turn-by-turn, very detailed instructions to people that are on the roads somewhat dissipates. And as a result, we get the state roadmap that we are more familiar with, which is very general in many respects. It does show some twists and turns, but you're no longer forced to follow a series of turn-by-turn instructions to get from Chicago to Lake Geneva. You basically follow Route 12. Mm-hmm. Even today, mm-hmm. You probably take the interstate, but the old Route 12. And so roadmaps could be much more generalized. They could be produced more cheaply. And companies like Rand McNally and later H.M. Goucher and General Drafting start to produce roadmaps on a massive scale. And they don't make money directly by selling them to consumers. They give them to the oil companies, sell them to oil companies in bulk, and also to a certain extent tire companies and the purveyors of automobile insurance.
Companies that have a commercial interest in promoting roads.
Companies that have a commercial interest in promotion of roads, and they become promotional tools. So this, from the late 20s all the way into the 1950s, early 1960s, you have these beautiful roadmaps that the inside, the actual roadmap doesn't vary very much from copy to copy. One map of Illinois more or less has the same information as another map of Illinois. But around it, you have all of this promotion of oil companies or of hotels. So these become a tool of still promoting roads, but now what they're doing is promoting an entire motorized landscape, including the gasoline companies and the hotels and roadside attractions that are associated with them. You start to get very specialized maps, which exist to this day, promoting roadside attractions as well, which are you're still relying on these basic roadmaps to get where you wanted to go, but these roadside attractions then give you more detailed instructions how to get off of this national space into their local spaces.
And it stands to reason that the audiences for these roadmaps is different than the audiences earlier in the century.
I mean, if you look at automobile motor ownership figures, they just expand tenfold. Almost in each decade, since the beginning of the century. And it's something like a third of the population by 1930 has an automobile, or at least on average. And ironically enough, during the Depression, it doesn't taper off all that much. So you now have motorists, the middle class, and leisure time. The actual designation of leisure time expands during this period, so you have a lot more people that are able to afford cars and use cars. And the infrastructure, this is the period when the motel is invented, and the infrastructure rises to meet it. I think the way to think about it, for people have memory of the 1990s, it's the kind of economic expansion that was associated with a personal computer, which we've seen more release recently with cell phones or smartphones, is, there's a whole economy that is being developed that is organized around this automobile culture. And a lot of what they're promoting, it's also a period where America is pulling back a little bit from its involvement in the Great War. There's a lot of patriotism that's associated with it. So motoring is seen as some sort of patriotic exercise, a way of learning your country. To a certain extent, the message it's ironic, because you're now expected to drive to national parks and this, or to particular attractions which are associated with historical events. Civil War tourism blossoms in this period of time. And you're expected to do this, and the maps very much embrace this in their art and in the text that accompanies them.
So that link between driving and patriotism is pretty explicit?
It's pretty, very explicit. And it never quite goes away. But it changes over time. But it's equally explicit after the Second World War, during my youth, where this is something where, and at an even larger scale, where people are expected to take these car trips, or at least the myth is there, the family car trip.
Yeah.
In order to learn about the country. And that becomes a very strong impulse that mapping along with other kinds of tourism publications, very definitely tap into and encourage, because it's economically in their economic interests in part to promote it. And I was saying that it was a bit ironic, because in some sense you get this kind of nationalized view of what people are supposed to do, where you're supposed to go. But there is this undertone, but you're not supposed to necessarily, motoring is also promoting the idea of individual freedom,
right?
Freedom of movement. And so you do have choices in the way that you organize your itineraries, but the points on the itineraries start to become fairly standardized. At least in the public sphere, it wasn't questioned much, in the United States. Even counterculture figures like Jack Kerouac embraced the notion of the automobile as freedom,
as promoting like rugged individualism, self-reliance. You see that to this day. In like, it seems like every other car commercial is kind of, you know, reinforcing that. Right. I mean, like Matthew McConaughey brooding alone in a car on a dark desert highway. You know, I mean, we could have a whole podcast about car commercials, but it's incredible like how persistent that myth is.
And you know, notice how empty those roads always are.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody else. I mean, that's why they have to film out in the West mostly, or places like Big Sur or something. And they probably block traffic in order to make it possible.
Yep.
You know, it's a very powerful image, and it's very definitely the image in those car commercials is exactly the way in which, you know, they talk about motor pioneers in the early 20th century, and people stylize themselves as pioneers. It's the idea is exactly parallel. Yeah.
Where does Google Maps and other other apps that navigate your route for you and give you you know, voice instructions as you're in your car fit into all of this? You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation about your lifelong love of road maps. Right. Maybe the best way to talk about this is through your own personal experience. Are you stubbornly holding on to your road maps, or do you occasionally dabble in Google Maps?
I use both. It depends on what I'm doing. For me, nothing surpasses a paper roadmap, or I guess you could, if I were to travel in Europe or so on, planning out an itinerary and knowing where everything fits, or making your own way, I guess, to a certain extent, from the possibilities that a map gives you, that a large map gives you that shows the entire network of possible routes. Which is the classic roadmap. For me, I take great personal pleasure in planning out my itineraries and not following, whenever I travel, established tours, because I enjoy that personal freedom. And, you know, determined as it might be by what guidebooks tell me is a good place to go, I still like doing that. And to me, there's nothing better than a map that gives you the view of everything at once, an entire glance of the United States or an entire state, or even at a more local scale of the entire region around a national park. There's nothing that surpasses the level of information that a paper, I wouldn't be in this business if I didn't believe that paper maps were very powerful in the amount of information they are able to deliver and how it integrates information. And I would say that I use Google Maps, or, you know, whatever, it's Apple Maps, actually. I haven't downloaded the Google app onto my personal cell phone. I'm too lazy, I guess, or too old to download a lot of apps. But I use it in places that I'm not familiar. Or my wife and I used it this morning to figure out what was the best, fastest way to commute so I could make sure I got to this interview on time.
Right, yeah.
And for that, as long as you have reserve a certain level of distrust, as you must, about the reliability of that information, and it's the ability of the algorithms to understand local and temporary conditions. They're great for that. I've used it when I've been in the middle of a European city where the map, the paper map, shows me a maze of routes that doesn't really tell me what I should do to get the heck out of there. And I'm thinking about getting out of Luxembourg City, which is a city that has great relief and a very complex route network, and we wanted to just get out of town. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we took the fastest, that we got the fastest way to get out of town or the most interesting, but we got out of town successfully by trusting what the in-car navigation system would tell us. And that, I, at some level, I'm a map geek, so I think that is really, really cool. But the problem with it personally is that it's like asking for directions, or it's the constant debate. You're asking, how do I get to someplace? Either you're asking for very explicit directions or you're just asking them to tell you where it is and you'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And I'd like the latter because I like figuring it out. And moreover, the figuring it out means, as a also as a professional geographer, it means that I have a greater sense of the landscape that I'm navigating. And I worry that things like Google Maps kind of shut down your perception of what's out there, sort of in the way that riding a train, or even more dramatically, a plane, sort of isolates you from the environment as you travel. So all of a sudden, you're plucked down in a place and you say, how did I get there?
It kind of negates what made car travel so distinctive when it first became a thing.
It does. I think that's the way to put it. Now, I'm sure that people, it's a great enabler. And some of it is just simply a reflection of the size of the device. With the largest tablet, you're never going to have a surface that's more than, a foot by half a foot.
Right. And if that,
it's just, if that, and so you're not, and which is not actually something that you're very comfortable looking at as you're driving around. So you rely on the verbal instructions that the thing is barking out and hope that you understand what they're saying as you see it in the environment. So there's a disconnect even at that level. But I think ultimately it comes down to, there's pleasure in, I'm paraphrasing another map scholar, pleasure in the idea of reading a map, which with the old road maps was very much present. And I think the fact that they still survive at some level indicates that people still, at least some portion of the population, value this. It may be something that's very stratified by age, but it's still there.
Jim Ackerman is curator of maps here at the Newbury and a grudging adopter of navigational apps. Jim, thanks for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Shelf Life is produced by the Newbury Library in Chicago, Illinois. If you have any thoughts or questions on anything you just heard, please let us know at facebook.com/Newbury Library. Thanks for listening.